Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
We've been talking a lot about school security since the tragedy in Newtown, but today we want to look at digital security. You may think your online accounts are safe, but in the past year, data breaches have jumped almost 70%, and hackers are increasingly targeting individuals, often by using something called social engineering to trick companies into resetting people's passwords. It happened to Matt Honan, a senior writer at Wired magazine. In a matter of minutes, two teenage hackers destroyed his entire digital life. They seized his online accounts and wiped clean his laptop, iPhone, and iPad. And they targeted Matt because apparently they wanted his Twitter account. It has a three-letter handle, at M-A-T. And those three-letter handles are apparently considered quite desirable in hacking circles. Matt Honan joins us from San Francisco. And Matt, how did you figure out who hacked you?
One of them, when they hacked me, put his handle that he goes by online on my Twitter account. That was one of the first tweets that they sent. It said the name of his group and his name, hacked this Twitter. And so I set up a second Twitter account on my neighbor's computer because none of my computers were working or I wasn't able to do anything. I went next door. And I basically started talking to him a little bit. I wanted to know how he had done this. And so I basically made a deal that, you know, I'm not going to press charges or cooperate in an investigation without a subpoena unless you, if you'll tell me how you did this. They first broke into my Amazon account, took some information from that, the last four digits of a credit card there, and used that to get into my Apple account. Once they were in there, that was my backup email for my Gmail. They then got into my Gmail, and from there were into the Twitter account. So it was a daisy chain attack. And the entire thing, it sounds complicated, but the entire thing only took about half an hour.
So it becomes like this cascade. Access to one thing leads to access to another thing.
Exactly. And I think that so many of us now use our email address as sort of a universal login. It's our username everywhere we go. We might use the same email address to log into Facebook and to Amazon and to Apple. That means that it's a single point of failure.
In your article, you have a transcript of a conversation between an Apple support tech person and a person pretending to be an Apple customer. And basically, despite this supposed customer failing again and again and again to provide security information, they still have some success with the support tech. Tell us a little bit about that conversation and whether it's real.
It was really surprising to me when I read it, and we did some work to make sure it was genuine because it was so surprising that when I first saw it, I was like, well, this can't be real. And I want to point out also that Apple has changed their policies, and that wouldn't be possible today. But what happened is that this hacker got in touch with tech support and basically just kept on guessing at information in someone else's account to try and get a password reset. In this case, he wound up guessing what the name of a bunch of this person's mail folders were. He was able to successfully guess that the customer whose account he was trying to get into had a mail folder called Google and Apple.
Which many of us probably have.
Right. Once he had that, he was in. And that's a problem that happens a lot with password resets. A lot of us have these common things that we think may be secure and we use them as security questions like, say our high school mascot or our date of birth. And almost all of that is findable now in the era of Google and Classmates and Facebook.
You say we often shouldn't be honest in those answers. We should make stuff up.
That's right. And that's something that I've heard even from companies like Apple who have security questions in place, is that sometimes it's not a good idea to answer those things honestly. And if, let's say that it asks, like, what kind of car do you drive? Well, there are only so many kinds of cars out there, and someone can guess that. And so you might want to make up an answer that has nothing to do with automobiles at all.
So what are some other techniques you see for people having their accounts accessed and passwords cracked?
The most common way that you see people getting into accounts is still via malware, which is where someone either loads a program on their computer or clicks on a website address, typically by accident or without realizing what they're doing, and something installs in their computer that more or less captures their keystrokes or does something else to find their password. And a lot of times that malware is targeted towards, specific sites, so it might only be looking for banking sites. And once you log into your bank, it captures that and sends it to a remote computer somewhere. Another very common technique is phishing, which I'm sure you've heard of, which is where you get an email. It looks like it comes from Facebook. It looks like it comes from some other company that you have an account with. You click that link, but actually it's just a website that looks like that, and you enter your username and password, and then
doom.
Right, exactly, and then doom. And despite a lot of people being aware of it, that's on the rise. And one of the big reasons it's on the rise is that so many people have smartphones now. And you have a smartphone, you get an email. It's not as easy to see who it's actually from as it is on your desktop. And so phishing is definitely on the rise. And then one of the most effective things is social engineering, where you call up a company and talk to their tech support department and basically trick them into giving you a password reset.
You said that after doing some research, you determined that with 2 minutes and $4 to spend at a sketchy foreign website, you could get credit card, phone, and social security numbers and home addresses of people. Then 5 minutes would be enough time to get into their Amazon or Netflix accounts. 10 minutes and you have their phone and cable accounts. 20 minutes and you're in their PayPal account. How is it possible? What is the chain that's happening there that's letting you crack one thing after another?
Some of that, I should say, has been fixed since my story came out. But one of the things that's really common is that companies will say, okay, well, this string of information is secure. One of the most common things that people think is secure is your social security number. And for most people, it is. But if your password, if your social security number happens to be in one of these databases, and there are quite a few of them out there where you can, and they kind of float around, but they're on the open web, you can log on, you can pay typically about $4, and you get someone's social security number and you know, this other information about them that might be on in a typical credit file. With that, you can, you know, get into one account, and a lot of times people use one account to get into another. So in the case of Netflix, which also has changed its policies, someone could get into Netflix and look and see the last four digits of a credit card number. You could use that to get into all kinds of other accounts. Apple used to use the last four digits of a credit card to get into their account.
Matt, I think many people think of social security numbers as sacrosanct, like those should never be online. How are they ending up on the web where people can access them publicly?
It's not totally clear how they're ending up on the web, but clearly they are. Some of the ways that I've heard that they are ending up in these databases are via banks that have gotten hacked, and so they get, you know, information about people who've gotten loans. Some of it's just from, you know, cases of identity theft. I mean, one of the reasons that people steal social security numbers is not necessarily to use them themselves, but to sell them. And a lot of those stolen social security numbers then end up in what are becoming increasingly comprehensive databases.
Do companies also have a responsibility to make sure we use complicated passwords so we can't just set our password to be password or 123456? Is that a responsibility they have?
I think it's one they should have. I actually was looking at a financial site that only allows its customers to use up to 8 characters in a password. Well, that's incredibly easy to crack. If you've got a program that you can basically download online and run on your computer, anybody can do it if you have the right tools.
But Matt, I believe you, in your case, you had a 19-character password and that still got hacked.
That's right. My Google password was 19 characters at the time. What happened was they basically did an end run around it by getting a password reset to my Apple email, which was the backup email for my Google.
That's Matt Honan, a senior writer at Wired Magazine. His article, Kill the Password, tells us how he got hacked and how vulnerable we all are. And Matt, you say that companies have a responsibility to make it more difficult for our accounts to be broken into. In fact, Google did have a security feature available that might have helped protect your account. How would that have worked?
You know, Google had made something available to me that I wasn't using. They had made two-step authentication, which is where you have to enter a code from your phone anytime you log on from a new or different computer. I wasn't using that, and I should have been. I don't know that companies can make us do stuff like that. I don't know that they should force us into using two-step necessarily, but they certainly ought to offer it as an option.
Of course, that makes accessing our accounts less convenient because it's one more step, and part of what you write about seems to be that trying to balance convenience and security is really difficult. It's hard to reconcile those two.
It's the age-old problem. It's been something that's plagued security people for as long as there basically has been security.
You also write that there used to be very little payoff for breaking into an individual account if you're a hacker, so really it was big corporate systems that were the prime targets. But tell us why it is that individuals now are so much more attractive to hackers. What are we putting online that people that we didn't used to that people want?
Well, I think quite often it's you know sort of the case of using almost a shotgun approach. If you can get into 100 different email accounts, maybe in one of those you might be able to get into an online banking account, and even just a few thousand dollars is a good payday. It's also very common now for hackers to be going after small businesses. They typically have a lot more money than individuals that might be accessible, but a lot less protection than a large corporation would have.
If we put aside Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, where so many people are, and we factor in all the grocery and pharmacy reward programs where you give them your information online and you get a little card, every time we create a new account like that, are we increasing the chance that one day we get hacked?
I think we are, especially, you know, if you're required to sort of remember these long, complicated passwords for each one of those accounts. That's one of the real problems. The prevailing security wisdom is that you have to create very long passwords with special, you know, characters such as, you know, asterisks and those can't be repeated because if you repeat them on one site and then another, that really makes it easy for someone to get into multiple accounts of yours if they find, you know, one login someplace. So, you know, are you really expected to remember 30, 40 very long, complicated passwords, and that's really hard to do. And so it means that people either use bad passwords or they reuse passwords.
Or you write them all down in one spot, which it is also bad to do.
That is certainly a prevailing conventional wisdom. I don't know that I actually agree with that. I think that there might be some wisdom in having some passwords written down.
Hmm.
Maybe you keep it somewhere really safe. Quite frankly, if you've got passwords written down and stored in your desk at home and someone gets those, you probably have bigger problems than someone just having gotten your passwords.
What if you're keeping a list of passwords in your Google Docs? Is that a bad idea?
Yeah, that's a terrible idea.
It is.
Don't do that. You know, one thing that I do think is useful is using a password manager program like LastPass or 1Password, which will store all those in an encrypted database. Having said that, I was using, you know, password management applications and I was hacked. It's not going to stop, but it certainly makes things better.
If you had to give us your top three pieces of advice on what we should do or not do to stay safe online, what would it be?
I think the most important thing is to not use bad passwords, which means, you know, something that's a word out of the dictionary or that has a very simple numerical replacement for a dictionary word. For example, you might have password and just have the number 4 instead of the A. There are programs that can break those. So don't use bad passwords. The second thing is don't reuse passwords. If you're using a password, the same password for, say, your email as you are on some other database, and that database gets hacked, one of the first things that happens is that the hackers who do that will take those logins and run them against Gmail and Yahoo Mail and AOL and other email providers, because there's a high likelihood that people are reusing passwords. Something else that I would do is basically shop around. And if you can find a place that offers you two-step authentication, which again is, you know, having a code sent to your phone or some other device in order to log in, you know, I basically don't use anything that doesn't offer that for very secure stuff, by which I mean financial or email.
Despite the inconvenience, go ahead and do it. Do you think, Matt, that if there's someone out there that hasn't been hacked yet, they're just lucky?
I think it's probably incredibly likely that almost all of us are going to have some of our information accessed at some point. You know, if you look at things like the LinkedIn password dump, where millions of logins are stolen from LinkedIn's servers and dumped on the web, that's beyond your control. Like, if you're an individual, that's beyond your control. And that kind of thing is happening more and more. And it means that maybe you already have been hacked and to some extent aren't even aware of it. It's also incredibly likely that we don't know about all of the big password thefts that are out there.
Matt, your argument overall is that the age of the password has come to an end. It's dead, and it has been for a while, but that no one seems to have figured out what will take its place. You do have some ideas, though, about what any new system will need to include. What are some of the basics?
I think if you look at what the future of online security is going to look like, it'll look a little bit like what banking looks like today. Say that today you wake up and you make a charge on your credit card in your hometown, and then suddenly 5 minutes later there's a charge on that same credit card in, you know, another country. Well, your bank is going to see that and flag it. And similarly, I think that you're going to start seeing companies, Google is already doing this a little bit, looking at a mix of signals that might include your location, the type of computer you're using, if it's a device that you've never logged in from before. And if they see something like that, they're going to ask for some additional information. That might be something that's biometric. It might be a code sent to your device that is a known device.
Biometric, like an iris scan or a fingerprint.
Or a fingerprint or something like that. You know, again, that information can be copied. But, you know, if it's being used as a mix of signals, it makes it a lot more secure. You're going to have to start seeing a mix of signals. And to some extent, that's not a great news for privacy advocates, but it is probably where we're going to go.
Overall, are you more optimistic or pessimistic about our future online security?
I'm more optimistic. I think that it's very easy for companies today to say, okay, well, we don't have a problem until they're confronted with it. But I do believe that enough people out there are trying to solve this problem, and there's enough money in solving this problem, that it's going to be something that we're going to see solved in the next 5 years.
Matt Honan is a senior writer for Wired. His recent cover story, Kill the Password, tells how he got hacked and how we all need to do more to protect our online identities. Matt, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Sasha.
Monday on Here and Now, ugly Christmas sweaters worn both ironically and earnestly. They're showing up everywhere. We'll talk to the author of a new book about them. And if you go to facebook.com/hereandnowradio, you'll see how folks at our home station, WBUR, are decked out for the ugly sweater day we're having today. Some great photos. Take a look online. By the way, on this day of the predicted Mayan apocalypse, check out our website for an end-of-the-world palindrome. News is next, Here and Now.